Start the podcast. Our first order of business is old business. If anyone has follow-up questions, since these two lectures this first week are kind of an integrated package, that's probably more relevant for next Tuesday when we will have finished this whole first block. But does anyone have any issues from the last lecture on Tuesday that you'd want to follow up with an initial question? Yeah.
This is actually not really content related, but I'm wondering if people would be willing to, for the first couple of weeks, use these little, like, make a little name card so that we can get to know each other's names for the first few weeks.
Sure, and I actually usually, but for reasons of inefficiency this time, didn't do it. I usually actually make those for everybody. So I will, on next Tuesday, bring elegantly done name cards to put in front of everybody. I think it's an excellent idea. Very good idea. Yeah?
Is it appropriate to have a small announcement?
Of course, it's fine. Also, an announcement from me. This Friday, tomorrow, from 10 until probably about noon, sort of activist academic named Steve Dubb, D-U-B-B. He's a close associate of Gar Alperovitz, who some of you may have know about, who's a prominent political scientist who works on questions of alternatives to capitalism. He wrote a recent book called Beyond Capitalism, which has gotten a fair amount of attention. They are embarked on a pretty interesting project called The Next System, which is an attempt at thinking through in a fairly comprehensive way what it means to go beyond capitalism in the practical context of the United States. So in a place where it seems dismally hopeless to do anything, they're thinking about what can be done now that move us in that direction, very much in keeping with my own way of framing these issues. In room 8417, social science, that's on the eighth floor at the lake side of the building. He's going to be here tomorrow to have a freewheeling discussion where he'll talk about this project, the Next System project. And he's particularly interested in finding ways for graduate students who are active in research and in thinking about new things and are at the beginning of careers so that they've got a long time horizon. He's interested in finding out how they can be relevant to students and how students can participate. Their hope would be to create a network of graduate students with these values and concerns nationally, who would be all on this kind of same page in this way of thinking about things, not in a doctrinaire sense, but just in a broad way, and that this could then be part of the process itself, creating a context for intellectual production that would be building the next system, as it were. So I don't know exactly how this will go. It certainly is not going to be a pressured situation where anybody has to sign up for something. You know, it's not like that. It's just a discussion where they want ideas as much as they want to tell you stuff. So that's 10 to 12. I'll be there. Joel Rogers might be there, too. He's very much in tune with this kind of perspective, and it should be interesting. And if you know any undergraduates who would like to come, you're entirely welcome. It's oriented more towards graduate students because they're doing research that would be then could be folded into this idea, but it's meant to be an open forum. Okay. 8417. Any other issues, announcements, queries from last time? Okay, it's 10 after. We'll go till a little bit before 11, take a break, and then have discussion. I think we can get through the rest of this outline in that period and then have about an hour to discuss. discuss these things. So we were in the second section of the outline on emancipatory social science. I reviewed these foundational propositions. The first statement of those propositions was at a very abstract level without a whole lot of content. And then the Marxian variant infuses those abstract propositions with content. And that move, by the way, moving from a level of abstraction in which content is very thin, and it can be so thin that it's hard to imagine anybody disagreeing with it. So it's pretty hard to imagine any social scientist disagreeing with the claim, many forms of human suffering and many deficits in flourishing are the result of existing institutions and structures, social structures. I mean, how could anybody say, no, it's not true that deficits in human flourishing are the result of social structures and institutions? So when you state it at that level of abstraction, it seems to not have any content. And it doesn't. It doesn't have content in the sense of something with which someone could disagree. It still can be important to articulate it at that level of abstraction because it clarifies what the work you have to do to make it a substantively important proposition. And that's what the Marxian variants do. It says, all right, we've got this very abstract concept. We're going to stick our necks out and say, we can identify in a very general way some key sources of suffering and deficits in flourishing. And as I've kind of distilled what I think is at the core of the Marxian tradition on these matters, it's the class structure and dynamics of capitalism, both for the critical thesis and the emancipatory thesis. All right, point two, the central goals of emancipatory social science. Well, this I discuss at some length in the chapter that was read. I'm just going to read the definitional paragraph because I just want to emphasize, even though I emphasized it in the text, I want to emphasize it again here. Emancipatory social science seeks to generate scientific knowledge relevant to the collective project of challenging various forms of human oppression. That's the point of it. To call it a form of social science rather than simply criticism or social philosophy implies that it recognizes the importance of systematic scientific knowledge about how the world works for this task. Now, that might seem like an innocent statement. It's actually a really loaded statement because it places a lot of weight on the possibility of scientific knowledge about social phenomena. For most sociologists, that's probably not all that controversial. Most sociologists loosely think of themselves as doing something like producing knowledge. And they don't feel too uncomfortable appending the word scientific to the word knowledge. It's actually not such a simple matter to defend the thesis that what we do is produce scientific knowledge about the world, as opposed to perspectives about the world or informed opinions about the world. And there is a certain current of contemporary social thinking. Sometimes it's identified with postmodernism, which really rejects the idea of scientific knowledge as having much standing with respect to social phenomena. Sometimes even more extreme with respect to anything. So knowledge becomes all relative, all positional, all a matter of perspective. I take a pretty kind of traditional and almost, I mean, to say it's simple-minded is not to praise it, but in this case, I think I want to insist on the simplicity of the core idea that there is a world out there independent of our thoughts and that we can make advances in understanding it that are subject to being wrong, not just different from your views of the matter. What renders something scientific, in part, is the upfront acknowledgement that it could be wrong, could be incorrect. It's not definitionally true. It's not true by pure logical deduction. It's not true by virtue of one's cultural priors. Things can be wrong. And that's what the progress of science is. It's demonstrating things that you thought to be true to be wrong. That's different from saying that there's ever a possibility of absolute certainty. So to say that it's scientific knowledge does not mean that we ever reach a point where we know for sure we're right, but it means we're always open to criticism, which means skepticism of one's own level of knowledge is an inherent feature of science. Let me make one other comment about this. As I said, we will periodically be brushing up against philosophy of science issues in the semester, but I don't want to constantly deflect us onto that terrain, because you can easily turn everything into a philosophical matter rather than a substantive sociological one. I do not think that the claim that we can produce scientific knowledge about society is a Western claim. I do not think it's Eurocentric. I don't think it's imperialist. I mean, one view is that we are, when we propose scientific knowledge about social relations and we study indigenous cultures, we are disrespecting indigenous knowledge. Right? So there's this one way of, in the contemporary discussions of these matters, is to use the word knowledge with a plural. There are knowledges, and this is Western knowledge, and it's in conflict with indigenous knowledge, and they have equal standing. My view is that indigenous knowledge has a lot of scientific elements to it, because human beings are scientific creatures. We produce cognitively robust understandings about how the world works, and it's always subject to screw-ups. A lot of indigenous knowledge about the medicinal properties of plants, for example, is the result of experimentation. Now, the experiments may now be lost because they were done, you know, 12 generations ago, and they tried things, and people got sicker from some plants and got better from others, and people recorded that. They said, aha, that's the plant that makes you better. Their theories about how it works may not be scientific. That is, they may say it's because of the spirit of the plant. Well, we know it's because of the alkaloids in the plant, and that's a renaming of the word spirit. It's just a deeper understanding of what the spirit of that plant is that does the work. There's nothing unscientific about indigenous knowledge, meaning that a lot of it is wrong, and much of it is right. A lot of it can be improved. And there are medicinal plants that, unbeknownst to the indigenous people, seem to cure the symptoms but actually cause long-term damage. And that's something that's correctable. Well, my point is, I don't take a relativist view about knowledge. I do believe that the cultural presuppositions that people bring to bear on their study and their efforts to produce knowledge, their own cultural presuppositions, may interfere with their ability to correct their mistakes. And that's absolutely as true for Europeans as it is for anybody else. No culture is immune from self-deception, wishful thinking, distortions, all these things that interfere with the progress of science. But that's as much a problem interior to the Western traditions of science as it is a contrast between Western traditions and other ways that people have worked on generating scientific knowledge of the world. It's my little philosophy of science speech, my homily. I think we have to take it seriously that we're trying to produce knowledge, and that means take seriously that you could be wrong. To call this emancipatory social science is to identify the moral purpose in the production of knowledge, the elimination of oppression, and the creation of the conditions for human flourishing. And to call it social science implies the belief that human emancipation depends upon the transformation of the social world, not just the inner life of persons. That it requires the transformation of the social world, not just the inner life of persons. That doesn't mean, the word just is important there. I'm not making an even stronger claim that human emancipation depends only upon the transformation of social world and not the inner life of persons. I'm not saying that. I do think transformations of the inner life of people is crucial. That's part of the process of changing the social world, is to change people's consciousness, to make them aware of things that they previously took for granted, and perhaps even to make them want things that they previously didn't want. That's different from just aware of things that they previously took advantage of. That's tricky stuff. We'll get into that when we talk about ideology. That'll be the stuff of our section of the course on ideology, the transformation of the inner life of persons, and how should we think about that. But that's not sufficient for human emancipation. Our institutions, our interactions and interconnections constrain the possibility of human flourishing, not just our lack of enlightenment. All right, that's the central goals of emancipatory social science. Next point, reflexivity. I tend to stay away from jargon that have X's in them. You know, I don't like to talk about praxis. I use the term practice, so when we're in that domain. Praxis and practice, I mean, some people make a big deal that praxis is different from practice. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. One has a Greek origin, the other has a Latin origin. I don't think it's a big deal. I like to keep terminology as transparent as possible. But the idea of reflexivity, then that word has come to have a pretty interesting meaning within social theory. And so I think it's worth understanding what that's all about. I think emancipatory social science has to be reflexive, meaning it has to theorize its own role in the phenomena it studies. Reflexive in that sense means being thinking about the role of the theories you're producing in the world you're trying to study. In that sense, emancipatory social science is reflexive in a way in which physics is not and need not be. That is, aside from some subtle points in quantum mechanics, perhaps, but let's forget about that sort of complexity. Physicists don't believe that their theories of the world actually change the way the world works. You know, the discoverers of DNA did not believe that once discovered, DNA functions in a different way than it did before it was discovered. So the discovery can have all sorts of consequences for how human beings relate to the natural world. Of course, that's crucial. But the natural world itself is not, and the laws and the mechanisms and the causal processes interior to the phenomenon you're studying are not affected by the theories. That's just not the case for social science. And it's certainly not the case for emancipatory social science, because the whole point of it is wanting the theories to make a difference in the world. And that creates some interesting kind of problems and issues. This plays itself out in certain kinds of research traditions. There's a research tradition called action research, in which the theorist and scholar is actively participant in producing the kind of world that they want to study. So they're not just outside observers. They are engaged in the phenomena that they are themselves studying. I mean, there's more to action research than that, but that's part of it. But as a general matter, just to constantly think about this, one of the features of emancipatory social science, this isn't unique to Marxism, it's true for feminism, it's true for critical race theory, it's true for critical environmental study. They all see the theory itself as a constituent element of the world they're studying. That's reflexivity. Science. Well, I've already given, I jumped ahead a little and gave you my main homily about science. Let me just make one other comment, which I've also, I think, mentioned briefly earlier. And that's the tension within the Marxist tradition between these two functions that it fulfills in the world. So if we think reflexively, how does Marxism work in the world? Well, one way it works in the world is as a mobilizing ideology. And another way it works in the world is as a scientific practice designed to understand how the world works, in which it itself is one of the things that's studied. Right? That's the reflexive moment of studying Marxism's own role in the world. Well, I think, as I said, there's this a really deep and unresolvable tension. You can't just wish it away. Between Marxism as a revolutionary ideology and Marxism as an aspiring scientific theory. It's very tough for the same ideas to play both of these roles. It's just really hard for them to function equally well as a mobilizing ideology and as a scientific framework for studying the world. And the reason is that as a revolutionary ideology, Marxism tries to build commitments on the part of people and resolve skepticism. Revolutionary ideologies don't constantly stress the importance of self-doubt about what you're doing and whether it will work and whether it's worth it, whether the sacrifices will pay off or whether you're just, you know, spinning your wheels. That's not the purpose of, that doesn't make for a good revolutionary ideology. Comrades, let's form this struggle and go out and sacrifice, and it may be all pointless because we may have a completely cracked theory about how the world works. But let's suspend that for the moment because, you know, it doesn't work that way. Revolutionary ideologies seek to speak authoritatively with certainty to give people confidence, whereas science, and I would argue this includes critical science and emancipatory science, must continuously encourage skepticism and question its own received wisdom. That doesn't mean that a scientist always just throws up their hands and says, I don't know anything. No, you say, this is the best I can do now. This is the knowledge that I think is the most secure, but I know I could be wrong in all these ways. The best emancipatory science, I would argue, and a practice that I would encourage all of you to do is to share with your audience where you're unsure, where you think the weaknesses are. So, you know, those of you who have read some of my things know that often at the end of chapters and the end of sections, I say, I have a section called unresolved problems and dilemmas, you know, sort of where I feel like I'm on shaky grounds. I try to make it as easy as possible for people to identify where I'm wrong and to offer improvements. Well, I just think this is unresolvable. And it's just something to live with rather than to moan and groan about. It does mean, and this is, you know, this may be an issue for some of you. You know, there are on campus very active Marxist-inspired social and political groups, and sometimes their internal practices have more the character of trying to shore up people's courage and their commitment to the doctrine to produce cognitive closure. At the extreme, that the term that's sometimes invoked for that is true believers, you know, people who really have absolute faith that they know what's right. And that's an intellectual practice that's common in what are called sectarian political groups. And it's in deep tension with the cultivation of healthy skepticism that the scientific practice needs. Marx is famous, so this is one of the few places I don't quote Marx a lot, but he's got some gems of quotes. Philosophers have only tried to interpret the world. The point, however, is to change it. I don't think the word however is in the original quote, but it seems to get put in the gloss on the quote all the time. And that's how I learned the quote in my political context, so that's how it's in my head. But I think the actual quote is the point is to change it, not point however is to change it. It's the 11th thesis on Feuerbach, very famous, the thesis 11. There's a journal that was called Thesis 11 because of that. That philosophers have only tried to interpret the world, the point, however, is to change it. But it is also fundamental that in order to change the world, we have to be able to understand it. So you could add another sentence to that quote. Philosophers have only tried to interpret the world, the point, however, is to change it. But if you want to change it in the right way, you have to interpret it properly. So this is not to disparage the importance of good interpretation, interpretation being a kind of general rubric for generating knowledge. Okay. That's point four, science. So to sum this up, if you want the kind of bumper sticker version of some of what I've been saying. The emancipatory in emancipatory social science helps us understand the right questions to ask. What questions should we be asking? We should be asking questions about that lead us to an analysis of present realities of oppression from the point of view of emancipatory alternatives. That's the emancipatory aspect of emancipatory social science, to study the forms of domination, inequality, oppression, calamity in the world as it is, from the perspective of its resolution in an alternative. That doesn't mean that the research has to only be about alternatives, but it should always be the standpoint with which you diagnose the world as it is the possibility of an emancipatory transformation. So the emancipatory in social science gives you the questions to ask. The social science in emancipatory social science gives you a methodology for producing answers. Social science tells you how to get the answers. The emancipatory bit tells you what questions are worth asking. Roman numeral 3. What kind of critical emancipatory theory is Marxism? Well, I've thought a lot about this, about if I were to kind of distill the logic, the overall logic of this as a kind of theory, how would I do it? And this is, I've done this, there's a variety of different ways I do this. And it's those of you who will continue working in this intellectual tradition, if you worry enough about it, you'll find your own ways of creating different distillations of what's the core, what's our grounding. Here's one way of doing it. So let me just run through these six propositions. First, emancipatory social transformation is possible. Well, that I've already identified as one of the fundamental theses. We can consciously transform social life in ways that expand the possibilities for human flourishing, for human freedom, autonomy, development, a lot of different things we can put under that. Social life is not something given by nature. It's not unalterable by its actions, it is not unalterable by our actions. It is deeply transformable. Now, it's not just emancipatory radicals who criticize existing institutions. Liberal sociologists criticize institutions all the time. But there's a difference in the nature and depth of the criticism. And I think one way of thinking about this is to ask the question, how changeable is society? How changeable is it in principle? And here I think one way of thinking about this is to use a kind of game theory metaphor. Social scientists, even if they're not using game theory in this kind of technical machinery of what's called game theory, often a good, rich environment of metaphors is the idea of a game. So when you think about games, there are rules of the game, and there are plays in the game. That is, given rules, actors make different moves given the rules of the game. You can change some rules of the game and it's still recognizably the same game. And rules change all the time. So the game of, just to play out this little metaphor, the game of basketball, the net is at a certain height and there's various rules that concern the way in which players can get the ball into the basket. There was a time when you were not allowed to touch the rim. So until I think about 30 years ago, I'm not sure when the rule changed sometime in the 60s or 70s, the rule changed. But before that, you were not allowed to touch the rim, which meant that dunking was impossible. Now, dunking is, it's actually not that big a part of the game. There's not that many points a game that are scored by the fantastic slam dunk. But they're pretty spectacular moments. In the modern game, people would say, if somebody proposed to get rid of that rule, they'd say, that's stupid. That's a great part of the game. That was a change in the rules, but nobody felt, aha, now we're playing a different game. Now that's an interesting point, because there are some rules, if you change, it really does become a different game. And some rules you can change which just improve the game. Indeed, you can change rules in some ways in which you think, aha, now we've really figured out what the right rules are for this game, that the previous rules were an impediment to the realization of whatever it is about that game that would make it the best possible version of it, right? So changes in the rules can improve the game. Some changes in the rules jeopardize the game. So take soccer, or what the rest of the world calls football. Since we have some international visitors here, if we say football, it means something different from soccer. So take soccer. At various times, the width of the goals have been changed. At various times, specific rules about tackling and about offsides have been modified. There's been various efforts to speed up the game, to make it easier to score or harder to score. There have been periods where, because the way in which defenses adapted to previous rules changes, there was very little scoring in the game, and people who run the game said, okay, now it's getting boring. We need to change the rules a bit to get the scoring back up. So one way to do it is to add, 50 centimeters to the width of the goal, make it a little tougher for the goalkeeper. All of those things, no problem. What if they change the rule about the ball hitting your hands? Well, if the ball was allowed to hit your hands, but you couldn't grab the ball, so now it can hit your shoulder, can't hit your forearm, I think, is the forearm okay? It's not okay. So there's a dividing line right here, right? Well, if you were allowed it to hit your forearm, it probably would be a bad change in the rules, but it wouldn't change the game fundamentally. The reason why it would be a bad change is because you can direct the ball with your forearm. You could do a little bit with your upper arm. It's pretty hard, though. You can with your head. That's why the heads are all right. But you could see, if you creep down and got your hands, then you could punch it. That would still be recognizably soccer. If you were allowed to grab it, then we would have a different game. It would begin to look a little bit more like rugby or something. Okay, so some rules of the game change the game itself. So we can make a distinction. It's not a clear-cut distinction, but we can still make it. Changes in the game you're playing, changes in the rules of the game that respect the game, and changes in the strategies within the rules. Politically, we can say that in American society, fights between liberals and conservatives are fights over basically plays within the game, strategies within a set of given rules. Political fights between reformists and reactionaries are struggles over what the rules of the game should be. And struggles over the game itself are struggles between revolutionaries and counter-revolutionaries. What game should we be playing? Should we play the game of capitalism or the game of socialism? Should we play the game of capitalism in which there are anti-pollution rules that are enforced or weak? Given the level of pollution rules, should we increase or decrease funding of the Environmental Protection Agency? Right, so these are different kinds of struggles. Emancipatory social transformation says the game itself can be transformed. So this is an elaborate metaphor. I think it's a pretty useful metaphor. Helps sort out different kinds of contexts. What an emancipatory social science says is that we could be playing a different game, and human flourishing would be enormously enhanced if we could play a different game. That doesn't answer the question of how you get from one game to the other, whether you do it by gradually changing how much of the body can touch the ball and then suddenly discovering you've destroyed the original game, or whether you've got to shoot the umpires and seize the rule books, tear it up, and just announce that we're now playing a different game. Right, it's revolutionary versus reform. Those are questions about what the strategies for actually producing a new game would be. One strategy, which we'll discuss at the very end of this semester, is maybe society is the sort of thing where we can just start playing a different game. We just decide we're not going to play this game anymore. We're going to start building different playing fields where we can play our own game. And then maybe we can keep expanding the spaces for this alternative game and crowd out the nasty game that everybody else is playing. Well, we'll talk about that when we talk about real utopias as a way of thinking about transformation. Point one was, then, emancipatory social transformation is possible, and the emancipatory transformation in question transforms the nature of the game itself. It's macro, it's systemic, it's not just tinkering with the rules of the game. Second point, agents for transformation come from within the game. The working class, in the case of Marxism, women for feminism. It's not that benevolent men decide after introspection and enlightenment that, yes, women should be allowed equal opportunity. No, the way in which social transformation takes place, and this isn't inherent in emancipatory social theory, but it is a feature of the Marxian tradition of emancipatory social theory. The agents for transforming the game come from within the game. To state it in a sort of simple and traditional forms, the oppressed must liberate themselves. It's not benevolent outsiders that are going to do the business of transformation. If it's not done by the people whose emancipation is needed, then you don't get emancipation, you get something else. Now, their lives could still go better. This doesn't imply the extreme position that any change that's brought from outside is going to make things even worse for people. No, benevolent change from well-meaning outsiders can sometimes improve the lives of people. But social emancipation requires the struggles and mobilization and collective will of those people whose lives are oppressed under the existing system. Third point, transformation comes through struggle. There are powerful interests at stake in fundamental emancipatory social change. People with privileges don't spontaneously relinquish privilege just through moral arguments, which doesn't mean that moral arguments aren't important, because it can weaken their resistance, can soften things up, it can create defections. But fundamentally, emancipatory social transformation requires struggles over power. That's an inherent feature of the problem. One of the key obstacles to social transformation are obstacles of the connection between power and privilege. And that connection has to be broken, or eroded, or challenged, or deflected. Doesn't mean it has to be ruptured. That's the revolutionary view, is that the only way to do this is through rupture. That may be true. I mean, I'm not rejecting the revolutionary claim, but that's just one possible way of thinking through transformation comes through struggle. But power has to be challenged. It has to be violent. Again, it could be nonviolent resistance as a form of challenging power. So the punchline then of these points is that oppressed people can transform the conditions of their own oppression through struggle. That's, if you want, the kind of simple way of thinking about this kind of emancipatory social science. It has that central thesis, which means, therefore, if we want to understand the obstacles to transformation, a lot of what we're doing is understanding the obstacles for oppressed people being able to transform the conditions of their own oppression through struggle. What are the obstacles to that happening? But, and here we get to the fifth point, people do this under constraints not of their choosing. Not of their choosing is another venerable Marxian expression. It comes from the opening lines of the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, where Marx says, to slightly edit his 19th century language, people make history, but not just as they choose. He said men make history, but not as they choose. But he unquestionably wasn't meaning it that males make history. It was just the way it was talked about in those days. The not just as they choose means that you do so under constraints which can thwart their efforts. And this then leads to the sixth point, the centrality of knowledge, the importance of knowledge. To effectively transform the world in an emancipatory way, we must understand the nature of the constraints themselves and how to transform them. And this requires real knowledge. We must learn from our mistakes, and that's really tough. It's requires concepts, theory, it requires intellectual skills, and these are not easily acquired, which puts a burden on intellectuals because they have the privilege of devoting time and energy to actually hone their intellectual skills, their ability to understand things, and a responsibility that those skills be used in ways that actually contribute to understanding the kinds of constraints and possibilities for social change. And there's a chronic problem throughout the history of the left, needless to say, but also, you know, more broadly, of learning the wrong lessons from history. It's not easy to learn from mistakes. It's often easier to learn the wrong lessons from mistakes. Just to give a kind of simple, obvious example, the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989, 1991, depending upon exactly what aspect of the collapse you're focusing on. The history of the Soviet experiment in a different kind of economic and political order from capitalism was not a happy one. It had lots of deep flaws. So what's our lesson from the history and collapse of the Soviet Union? So here's one lesson. Socialism is impossible. There is no alternative to capitalism. That's the Margaret Thatcher lesson. Another lesson is centralized bureaucratic command of complex economies is suboptimal. Socialism must be decentralized and democratic in order to be dynamic. It's another lesson that one could learn from the fate of the Soviet Union. Well, it's crucial, obviously, to have the theoretical tools and the way of building our knowledge to know which of these is right. It's not obvious. I mean, you know, I'm deeply committed to anti-capitalist socialist transformation. But I can't say that I have an absolutely nailed down evidence and argument that the simple-minded conservative conclusion is false. I think the balance of evidence doesn't support it. You know, this is my scientific mode of talking. But it is possible that the ideal of a democratically robust, decentralized, and open society, but that's not a stable equilibrium. It may not be possible. It'll degenerate either into authoritarian socialism or back to democratic capitalism. It may be that the kind of world that I want would not be stable. Again, when I say it may be, I'm just affirming the fact that these are difficult and open questions around which skepticism is justified, not a sign of moral weakness. On balance, I do think such a world is possible, and that's why I devote my energies and academic work towards trying to clarify it. But these are hard, not simple matters. Okay, I want to get through this so that we can have a full board discussion without cutting into the time. Let me just briefly review these next points. Some of these are in the readings already. If you buy into this broad way of doing social science, if you want to help elaborate and work within an emancipatory critical framework of social science, then I think you have four tasks. In the book, I described it as three because I folded the first two together. I now think it's just clearer to describe this as four tasks. First task is to elaborate the normative foundations, what your view of the central values that are in play in your judgment about society. The second is the diagnosis and critique of the world as it exists in terms of those normative foundations. They provide the criteria by which you ask, do these institutions and social structures help or hinder the realization of these values, and in what ways? The third task is envisioning alternatives, viable alternatives, alternatives which, if you could create them, wouldn't blow up in your face, wouldn't have such negative side effects that the cure is worse than the disease, etc. And then finally, a theory of transformation. As I've said, I've, for whatever reasons, I kind of like nautical or adventure trip journey metaphors. So the chapter on socialism in the book is called The Socialist Compass. I like to think of this as a journey. The normative foundations tells us what are the principles by which we judge the place where we currently live. The diagnosis and critique tells us why we might want to leave that world. The third task tells us at least something about where we want to go with greater or lesser precision. It may just give us a compass to tell us if we're moving in the right direction. It may give us a clearer map of the destination or vision of the destination itself. And a theory of transformation tells us how to get from here to there. I thought about reorganizing the course this year strictly around these four tasks. So, and I may try to do that. It would be, you know, when you've been teaching a course many times and it has two properties. One is it's like an old friend. I mean, I really am comfortable in the company of this class. I know what's coming next. I can change things without worrying that it's going to unravel part of the story later on. You know, I get very excited about some of the lectures because there's some old friends that we're going to visit that are really just such sweet ideas. So I'm super comfortable in this class. To do a major reorganization, it's not just that it's a lot of work, which is fine. I mean, that doesn't bother me. But it's anxiety producing for the professor. You know, I'm not sure if exactly this is the right way to do it. I think I do want to try, given that this is now the way I think we ought to think about the tasks, the natural way of organizing this class is in terms of these tasks, right? You know, we would spend a couple of weeks on normative foundations. We would then have a big block on the diagnosis and critique. We would talk about the real utopian and other ways of thinking about alternatives, and then we would do a theory of transformation. But these themes will be constantly interjected, but the class isn't organized in this manner. All right, now in 10 minutes, and then we'll take our break, and then we'll have an open-ended discussion. Let me just briefly rehearse the issue of the normative foundations. We'll talk about that. Next week we do kind of capitalism as the kind of centerpiece of the diagnosis and critique. And then three lectures from now, I'll talk about the broad shape of the theory of transformation, and that'll end this introductory block of the course. In the book, I have two normative foundations. Subsequently, as I've thought through these issues and worked on them, I've moved towards four. In the article in the ASR, I think there's just three, right? I added sustainability. I now think that the way to think about this is in terms of four principles: equality, democracy, community, solidarity, and sustainability. I think having all four of these, recognizing these as having somewhat distinct, but they're overlapping, they're interconnected, standing, really does cover much more effectively the full moral space that underlies both the Marxian and broader and other traditions of emancipatory theory. So let me just briefly explain what each of these are. The equality and democracy ones are well discussed in the book. The community and sustainability ones are not touched on explicitly in the book, so I'll explain those as well. First, equality. In a just society, all persons would have broadly equal access to the material and social means necessary to live a flourishing life. That's the value of equality. When I say I'm an egalitarian, I believe in social equality, what I mean is, in a just society, all persons would have broadly equal access to the material and social means necessary to live a flourishing life. Now, there's a lot packed into that sentence. For those of you who have taken political theory and have been in debates about John Rawls and other theories of justice, you'll recognize some of the ideas, some of the issues here. And it would I'll just briefly allude to them here. I discuss some of these issues in the book, but it certainly needs a more thorough treatment. First of all, the key egalitarian word is equal access. Not simple equality or equal opportunity. Equal opportunity is a pretty attractive idea. I mean, I'm all in favor of equal opportunity. I think the world is a worse place with unequal opportunity than with equal opportunity. But I think equal opportunity is a bit misleading. It has a little bit too narrow, potentially narrow, set of implications. In particular, it's often thought of in terms of what's called starting gate equality of opportunity. So as long as people have equality of opportunity at age 20, as young adults, then if they screw up, as long as they screw up because of their choices rather than because of just bad luck, you know, they get hit by a car, well, that's different. But if they make bad choices and suffer later, well, too bad. They had equal opportunity. They just blew it. Well, I think that doesn't satisfy the moral intuition. And one way of thinking about what the moral intuition is, in some ways it's a pretty demanding way. If you think about a family, a really loving family, where people really care about each other's well-being, and you are parents and you've got a wayward, rebellious teenager who screws up continually and then gets their act together in their 20s, but needs extra help at that point in order to get back on track. Well, a family that said at that point, tough luck. I mean, you know, you had a good chance in high school and you screwed up. We're not going to help you now. You'd think, that's really monstrous. That doesn't reflect the values that a family should have about care. Well, I think those values really should apply to the world at large. There's no reason why the kind of compassion and love and concern for the genuine well-being of another person should be something that's only bound together by kinship. And that's the equal access principle. The equal access principle says people should have multiple chances, that people can screw up. And still, they should have access to the conditions to live a flourishing life. Now, there may be practical constraints on that, the equal access thing. You know, even in the best of all possible worlds, it may be that there will be some people in the nature of their continually screwing up and not taking use of the access that's available. It may be that they do end up with less access. Well, because there may be constraints. But those are the same kind of constraints that a family would feel when they would end up feeling so exasperated and so frustrated after so many times that they feel, okay, now the best we can do is the tough love approach because maybe that's going to solve the problem. And then that doesn't work, and then they're just despairing. So that's tragic then. But it's not you can't indict the family for the tragedy under those conditions. Whereas if at eight, when your 25-year-old previous wayward child gets their act together and then wants your help to be able to go back to school and you say you had your chance, that's something to be criticized. Okay, that's the equal access thing. Social and material means are both there. It's not just a question of access to resources. Resources are crucial. I mean, I think they're really crucial. But stigma and social exclusion are equally salient with respect to what it means to have access to the conditions to live a flourishing life. Stigma can be incredibly damaging. And status recognition issues can be incredibly damaging to the possibility to live a flourishing life, and are equally subject to criticism. Nancy Fraser, who's a philosopher at the New School, calls this the problem of social recognition, and that it's equally important as material deprivation. Now, I don't know if it's equally important or not. I don't know if more harms in the world are caused by material deprivation or by social misrecognition. You know, that I think it's highly variable. But they're both salient in any case. And finally, flourishing life. Well, that's a big topic. I discuss it a bit in the book. I like the word flourishing. This is what's called in the literature a kind of neo-Aristotelian view of human well-being. That is that we all have potentials which can be blocked and thwarted or can develop and flower. It's a kind of dynamic view of human potential and its realization. It's at the core of, I think, the Marxian tradition of thinking about well-being. It's the realization of our potentials. And that's what flourishing is trying to tap. Okay, well, I'm spending too much time in order to give us plenty of time to talk. Let me just say democracy. In a fully democratic society, all people would have broadly equal access. Again, that's the egalitarian principle. To the necessary means to participate meaningfully in decisions about things which affect their lives. Notice that the core of democracy is political equality. Right? So equality is essential for democracy, political equality. It may be that economic equality is essential for political equality as well, that people can't have equal access to the necessary means to participate meaningfully in decisions unless they have broadly equal access to the material conditions to live a flourishing life. So there may be a deep interconnection between them. But it may not be quite so deep. It may be that you can go pretty far on political equality and still have quite a bit of economic equality. It's possible that there may be devices by which you can move more rapidly on one or the other. So I don't think they're simply mirrors or reflections of each other. Community solidarity. Community solidarity expresses the principle that people ought to cooperate with each other not simply because of what they personally get out of it, but also out of a real commitment to the well-being of others. That's what solidarity and community mean, is that you cooperate with others in collective projects of various sorts, not just because of what you get out of it, but because of your commitment to the well-being of others. I use the word community to describe that principle in the ordinary, mundane cooperation of social life with other people, and solidarity when the context of cooperation is collective action. But you could use the word solidarity for both settings. I think terminologically, solidarity has come to be thought of as the way we talk about people being in community with each other, that is sharing a commitment to each other's well-being when they are in common struggling for some goal, so collective action. So that's kind of the convention in which the term is used, but I think the underlying value is pretty similar, very closely connected. People don't engage in struggles for civil rights or workers' rights just because of what they individually will get out of it. Empirically, I'm saying they don't. If that's all they cared about, they wouldn't engage in the struggle. They would watch other people do it. Yeah?
I know you're trying to rush to the end here, but is self-interest inherently bad?
Absolutely not, and we'll bring it up. That's okay. A good launch pad for thinking about this. Note that I said not simply because of what they personally get out of it. I would not want to say that it's the principle that people should cooperate with each other not because of what they get out of it, but only because of their concern. That would be, a much different view about the value in question. Finally, sustainability. Future generations should have access to the social and material means to live flourishing lives, at least at the same level as the present generation. Now note, this doesn't say future generations should live at the same material standard of living, at least at the same level of the present. It doesn't say anything about what the material standard, how much material consumption we should have. It says they should have access to the material means to live flourishing lives at the same level as the present generation. The present generation has a surplus of means to live a flourishing life. That is, in rich countries. The material consumption of people in the United States is above what's necessary to live a flourishing life. And it's unsustainable. What would be the sustainability thesis says that future generations should have access to at least the same level of social and material means to live flourishing lives as the present generation. But it's pegged to the conditions to live a flourishing life. You don't need, average new home construction in the United States is 20, 700 square feet now, I think, 2,500 square feet. The average new home construction, family sizes are smaller than they've ever been. In 1960, the average size of new home construction was 1,500 square feet. It is simply not the case that in order to live a flourishing life, average home construction needs to go from 1,500 to 2,500 or whatever it is now, square feet. It's not true. That's not a material condition to live a flourishing life. So sustainability has to be thought of with respect to the flourishing issue and the material means necessary for it. This is a anthropocentric view of sustainability. That is, I care about the environment because of what it means for human beings. It's not a Gaia-centric view. It's not a pan creature view. It's an anthropocentric view. A little glib, but if we were currently in an ice age, I wouldn't worry so much about global warming. If we were in an ice age and had adapted and our civilization was somehow lumbering along with constantly fighting the encroachment of glaciers as they came to flatten Wisconsin once again and all these things were happening, and scientists were saying, the energy sources we're using are going to warm the planet a bit and make it more temperate, I don't think I would say I would get on protests. Maybe I would, but so my concern with global warming is that it makes the planet a less conducive place for human flourishing. Some radical environmentalists will object to that. They will feel that there should be no privileged position given to human beings with respect to the planet, but in practice, I don't think it makes much difference because most of the things which make the planet better for human beings make it better in general. But there are specific instances where there may be some tensions between these two perspectives. I think we should take our break. Let's make it a little bit shorter. Let's start bang at 15:15, and we'll have 45 minutes for discussion. Okay?